I was going to use the overhead projector, but it takes me too long to get it set up, so I'll use the blackboard. Use the old style methods. One day, a middle-aged gentleman was at a dinner party, and he was very delighted to see a former lady friend at this party. And so he rushed across the room and said, "Dear, it's so very good to see you again. What have you been doing since I last talked to you 5 years ago?" And she said, "Well, for one thing, I've grown 1 year older." I think that sort of sums up the situation. I mean, we hesitate to grow old, at least some people do. And this is the subject for today. I will discuss aging and the aged. And is your husband going to be here? Fine. And I hope, is Dr. Bergendorf here?
Yes,
sir. Oh, fine. Because as we get into this, one of the things we're going to discuss probably is, should we put grandmother in the sunset home, you know? Or should they put me there when the time comes, you see? Now, as is my custom, I shall begin with the readings from George MacDonald, not from his anthology today, but from a very interesting book called The Diary of an Old Soul. Al Rogness sent me this. He wrote the foreword to it. It's a very interesting foreword. You can get it from Augsburg. And it's a little poem for every day of the year. I shall read two or three of them. The first one is for January 1. "Lord, what I once had done with youthful might, had I been from the first true to the truth, grant me now, old, to do with better sight and humbler heart, if not the brain of youth. So wilt thou, in thy gentleness and ruth, lead back thy old soul by the path of pain, round to his best, young eyes and heart and brain." And then for October 16 and 17, "Now I grow old, and the soft gathered years have calmed, yea, dulled the heart's swift fluttering beat. But a quiet hope that keeps its household seat is better than recurrent glory's fleet. To know thee, Lord, is worth a many tears, and when this mildew age has dried away, my heart will beat again as young and strong and gay. Stronger and gayer tenfold, but, oh, friends, not for itself, nor any hoarded bliss. I see but vaguely whither my being tends, all vaguely spy a glory shadow blent, vaguely desire the individual kiss. But when I think of God, a large content fills the dull air of my gray, cloudy tent." And then as we think about the aging, a reading from George MacDonald, on love. "It is by loving and not by being loved that one can come nearest to the soul of another." My interest in aging stems not only from the fact that for the past 10 or 15 years that my parents were getting older, but I too, as I've told you on many occasions, when you reach 39, you start thinking about these things. So I've had some experience myself in aging. And furthermore, in the field of radiation, for quite a time we thought, well, what we see in an irradiated subject is like aging. And we thought what a useful technique this would be. There are limitations to this that I'll discuss later. First, I probably should define what aging is. And it's a progressive deterioration with the passage of time, with a decrease in vitality and an increase in vulnerability. An Now, what are some of the things that we see happen physiologically and anatomically? We do see, to an extent, organ atrophy. That is, some organs change in size, they grow smaller. There is a reduction, unfortunately, in the cellularity of the central nervous system. You're losing some neurons. There is usually an increase in the amount of fat, connective tissue, and also pigments. There's a change sort of in the nature of our ground substance in our body. There's a decrease in muscular strength, reaction time, fertility, oxygen utilization, cardiac output, a deterioration in vision and hearing. And you start the deterioration in hearing, you really peak out at about 10 years of age. In muscular coordination, you probably peak out at about 20 or a little over 20. There's a reduced adaptability to environmental changes. There's usually a slower recovery rate following injury and a change in the concentration of certain chemical elements. It sounds like we're a 10-time loser, but there's one overriding factor. For with age, there's a great increase in wisdom. So there. I gave an aging lecture to the physiology class in a professional school, and one of the questions, as I recall on the exam, was some of the characteristics of aging had to do with this, and one of the students did put, he listed some of these, but there is an increase in wisdom with age. So he did hear this. He didn't know whether I was kidding or not, I guess. But I was pleased to see it. There was only one out of 90 who noted this. I can't remember whether he got an A or not. Now, you say, but there are some living things that exist for a long time. And usually one of the things that are always brought up are trees. They're the oldest living things on the face of this earth. I mean, there were trees that are still living that were here when Columbus came. There are some here that even when Leif Erikson came. And so that makes them pretty old, you see. And some of them were pretty big then. But when you analyze a tree, and Mrs. Collins can tell you more about this than I can, but really the tree that was there then isn't really sort of the same tree, because a lot of that stuff's dead. And the live part of the tree is around the outside of it and new, you see, and the rest of it, it's sort of dead. It's just like we sort of built up live tissue as we sort of grow wider and sort of replace all the others. It's true that many of the tissues that we have, of course, are not what we were born with. But generally speaking, our central nervous system there is not too much replacement, unfortunately, of the neurons there. There's another thing that's rather interesting to observe, and you've seen it, but maybe you didn't notice. But you can take and this is where we get in sort of the programming of aging. And I'll get into a little of this a little later here, but just to mention this as I think of it. And one of the demonstrations I often use, like when I talk about aging to a professional class, I'll bring in a piece of green oats or green wheat or green barley, and then I'll bring in a dry one. And if you've ever passed one of these fields, you know, it'll be green one day, and you'll come back about 3 or 4 days later, and it's essentially all brown, because it's aged. And it's essentially related to the fruit. In many plants, with the fruit production, the species dies. This is true, of course, with the annuals. Now, what are some of the theories on aging? We can say right away that there is no one system, usually, that you can say, well, this is the limiting factor. To some of you, it may be your kidneys. To somebody else, it may be your heart. To somebody else, it may be your liver, or a combination of these things. So let's examine some of the theories and hypotheses that have been submitted or evolved. And any time you have a lot of hypotheses, you know they haven't figured it out, you see. Now, Back in the old days, a fellow named Metchnikoff and others said, well, it's really an accumulation of toxins in the body. And as you grow older, these accumulate, and some of them say, and they're sort of what we call free radicals that accumulate, and these are toxic. And to even to prove the point, radiation causes free radicals, and these are toxic to the body, and there's general deterioration with this. And a lot of them, for a while, you know, we had this big Bulgarian milk craze, or cultured buttermilk, you know. Boy, you drink a lot of this because you're eliminating, or you're changing the flora of your GI tract, you see. And boy, this is really great, because look at all those Bulgarians down there. Well, you go down there and, boy, look at all those old Bulgarians, you know. Well, the truth of the matter is, and that's where it came, is they say, boy, we ought to drink Bulgarian buttermilk or moose milk or something, you know. Cultured buttermilk, they got the cultures, and a lot of people were drinking it. I still drink it sometimes. My wife drinks a lot. That's why she drinks more than I do. That's why she looks a lot younger than I am, even though she's older than I am. probably. But when they got to investigating these Bulgarians, they found out they just looked old. They weren't old, you know. So some people sort of still believe in this, and maybe it contributes. And maybe it's tied up with the second one, where we say there's sort of an increase in the barrier in the hematohisto barrier. That is the barrier between the blood, which brings the nutrition to the cell, and the cell of interest. It has to cross some membranes and some tissue to get there, usually. All right, with the passage of time, there is increasing collection of materials, obstruction, and so forth, and we just don't operate as well. It slows it down. The transport and diffusion processes are effective. And some people can make a pretty good case for this. Certainly, we know that this is true in certain radiation. You not only have some cell damage and death, but there is an increase in connective tissue and other materials. There's change in ground substance. A friend of mine at the University of Rochester named George Cazaret, he feels that this certainly does contribute. And I think this is part of the reason that we make a big push. Now, we're making a big push for exercise. And perhaps this is as good a place as any. I mean, why can Professor Berganoff, Dr. Berganoff, I mean, he comes to Holden Village here, and he gets here, and the second day he walks to Holdener Heart, you know, or beyond, where I have to even, he's in far better shape than I am, and he's gotten me by a few years, you know, but I'm sure that he probably exercises quite a bit. He takes long walks, he probably more than I do, or maybe he's just tougher. But it's very important that we do keep exercising, and I can't stress this enough. I've already told some of you, the chief and I, we don't do enough of it. But it has a therapeutic effect in many ways. But we go out at night, and we fortunately live out in the country. If you do this in a city, there'll be a lot of people checking you off as nuts, you know. But at night we go out, and there's no street lights out there. And we're sort of out in the country, and we run. I mean, we jog, we walk, and jog, you know. And while we're walking, we talk over the settle the world's problems, and more importantly, the problems that face us as a family. And sometimes we have them. And you can sort of talk it out, and it's probably some of the only time I see my wife in a way. So it has a therapeutic effect, but probably as important, almost, is that it really keeps us in shape. But our only trouble is we don't run quite enough, and we don't cycle enough and often enough on Sunday, nor swim enough. But the point I'm trying to make is that you should adopt a routine of exercise and continue it throughout life. None of this weekend warrior stuff. I mean, where you go, boy, I'm going to get my exercise today in a few hours, and then you knock it off for a couple of weeks. This isn't the way to do it. And winter presents a problem, but there again, you can walk and run. Running is good exercise, as long as you don't overdo it. But also lifting weights is also very good. And I think Jack LaLanne probably isn't too bad. I don't personally like the guy especially, but my wife is very fond of him. And so another one that some people believe is that we sort of have a fixed reserve. And if one analyzes the caloric intake per gram, it pretty much adds up, sort of a mouse to an elephant or something, sort of the calories per unit weight consumed per lifetime is approximately similar. A fellow named Pearl figured this out many years ago. Before him, I think, a fellow named Rubner. And there is some basis for this, I think, even today, that certain enzyme molecules have sort of a fixed life. And perhaps with their exhaustion, maybe there is a deterioration. You say, well, but when you exercise, you might be using it up faster. Well, there's some compensating things here, especially in sort of extending corollary circulation and really increasing your lung capacity and so forth. Now, the application, however, of this exhaustion of a fixed reserve, I think we can only apply probably after adulthood. There was a fellow named McKay at Cornell, and now several others have done this. But McKay found out that if he starved rats, kept them on a very low caloric intake for the first 1,000 days of their life, and a 1,000-day-old rat is a very old rat. Many of them die, certainly by that time. Some die at 600 or 700 days and as an old rat. But he kept them starved out to about 1,000 days. He couldn't go beyond because then he had permanent effects. And then he put them on a full ration, and they essentially then they then grew and essentially doubled their lifespan. Now, this was of a great interest to the people in gerontology. However, its practical significance probably has some limitations because you know, if you starve your kids, you don't know quite when to stop starving them, and without causing permanent damage. And then you'd have to listen to them howling all the time, you know. We have raised swine, and I'll mention that just a little bit tonight in my life with the pigs, but for many years, I think 10 years or so at Washington State University, there was an experiment going where they kept some swine on 70% of what ordinary swine will eat. You see, a pig will essentially balance his own ration, and you can give a self-feeder, and he'll eat well. He'll eat very well. So if you take 70% of that and keep some swine on that, they're sort of built for speed, sort of. But they're much healthier. They have better offspring. They're better mothers, generally speaking. And chances are they probably live longer, too. And this brings us then to the food thing. And I'm going to mention that when I draw some charts here, so I won't mention this overweight bit at this point. But I'm going to hit you with eating too much, too, today. So if you don't want to hear it, you can leave now. On another one that's proposed is that it's and I've already mentioned it's already coded in our genetic setup that there's probably sort of a lifespan that's relatively fixed. And I remember when Sir John Hammond, who was probably one of the great animal scientists of the world, certainly in the last generation, he died relatively recently in England. He was knighted. He was at Cambridge for many years. And we were discussing aging, and I asked him, well, sort of we were discussing aging, how can you assure long life, sort of? And he said, well, I'll give you the same answer as Pearl gave me many years ago. He says, pick a mother that has a long life. And this sort of sounds funny, but what it does point out is that probably if you have parents that grew to a very old age, your chances are better for living a long life if you take care of yourself. And yet within the fall, and part of them feel that aging then is due to a faulty copy mechanism in our somatic cells, you see, too, that it's programmed into our somatic cells that they're not as good for as long a time or as maybe somebody else's. And certainly we do know of certain structures that have a programmed time. And I'll give you one very good illustration of this. When an egg is hatched, during the hatching of an egg, there are certain cells that hold down the wing, because it isn't to the bird's advantage to be flopping his wings when he's inside an egg. It'd be pretty tough going anyway. But at birth, of course, he's going to use his wings. So these cells that really hold down these wings die. I mean, they disappear. Huh? It's programmed into them that at a certain time, no more. All right, so the smart guys, they go in there and they took out some of these cells and transplanted them somewhere else, you know. Well, they transplanted them somewhere else and they died about the same time there. It's something in there that's coded, you see. Well, some people like to extend this and say, well, maybe it's sort of coded in there. It almost sounds like predestination, doesn't it? But there are some who hold to this, and we do, of course, know that certainly the genetic constitution does contribute. And somebody else says, well, it's sort of a combination, or it's a general effectiveness that many things sort of break down, and the net result is an effect on our homeostasis. That is, those mechanisms that sort of control and balance out our system. And it's a very complex one, and anything that affects our complex feedback mechanisms, and we have a lot of them functioning. This is what goes haywire. Now, I'm going to talk now about some of the expressions of aging and to look at some aging populations. I hope you can see this board. Now, some friends of mine were very proud of themselves when they started their radiation studies in the 40s. And they found out that if they plotted age-specific mortality, that is, if you, on a semi-log scale, if you say, well, here, at this point is one death per 1,000, there's one death per 100 here, and one death per 10 here, and and you plot this, and it's sort of, for many species, you can plot this, all you have to do is change what the abscissa here is, relative to age, you see. And for a period of their lifespan, it draws a straight line. See, biologists, although they have a great appreciation for curves, prefer to express things in a straight line. And they thought they really had come up with something until they checked the literature and says, Gompertz thought of this in 1850. And so it's called the Gompertzian plot. And this is a useful thing in expressing data on mortality. It really isn't really highfalutin. All it tells you is that as you grow older, your chances of dying are better. Now, generally speaking, for man, it's sort of like this. But it depends on your population and your... when you started it. I mean, it was different many years ago because there was we have adjusted it sort of downward. In other words, we have lower infant mortality now. And when you're in the age of about 10 to 20 here, as the physicians here know, boy, they really got good bounce back in this age. I mean, a lot of things can happen to a child here. Where they can really recover rapidly, where this is not the case here. And also, there's a very low mortality at this age. Now, this isn't so true for some populations. In India, it looks, you have still a very high mortality, and the curve is more like this. The Swedes and the Hollandese are even better here. The Scandinavians, with the exception of Finnish men, Finnish men, I think, are more sort of, I mean, they live a very Spartan life, and this is also true with the Spaniard. So you have a family of curves that describes various populations. Now, what do certain inputs have on this curve? Before I do that, I should tell you sort of how we look at radiation in another way. And if you'll forget this ordinate here, we'll have another ordinate here. And we often say just what are the percent surviving? And if you radiate a population either with an acute dose, so that you don't give them enough so that you kill them, generally speaking, well, I'll just first draw sort of a mortality curve for an animal, whether it's mouse or dog or anything, and it sort of goes along like this, and you always express it in sort of when are half of them dead, sort of the median life span or something like this. Well, we had quite a large study at the University of California. It was initiated before I arrived. I've done this thing on mice, and we have some other work, or we initiated on other animals, but let us look at first on the dogs. Now, what happened on the dogs was that if this is a control, if we gave them 100 R to a dog, if you give 300 R to a dog, you may kill him acutely. But 100 R, the curve went along like this up to 7 years. And they wondered whether they really turned on the X-ray machine, you know. But then they sort of started to lose a little ground here. So that they probably, with 100 R, shortened their lifespan maybe a year, or a little over a year. The other thing we did, or they did, before my coming there, they decided to put some dogs out to people, good purebred beagles, out to people who would take very good care of them. And they would report in their care and so forth. And here is the curve on them. To make a long story short, half of these controlled were still alive at 12 years of age, and those that were put out to people such as you, were half of those were gone at 4 years, 4.5 years. Now, the trick here is that we don't allow cars in our kennels, you know. I mean, because things are tough on the outside. You probably found that out. And one of them are automobiles, especially in California. If you give 300 R and those that survive, there's a little different curve here, and it sort of maybe adds another, or shortens it another year. So, and we see somewhat the same thing in other animals. In mice, I have shown that, and others have too, that. And it's different, of course, if you take, rather than an acute dose, if you give them only, say, instead of 100 R at one time, give them 1 R a day, you get a different thing. And you can go up to several hundred R, giving 1 R a day during adulthood, and you may have a hard time really showing an effect on the lifespan.
Is there any correlation to what those dogs had?
Pardon?
What
the dogs of the radiation diet? Yeah. There's a... Generally speaking, there were a few more tumors in those that were irradiated, and probably more chronic diseases in the others. But all this stuff all of it isn't tabulated yet, because we still have a lot of the dogs still alive, and we're operating down in here sort of. But the patterns of death were not too dissimilar. There were over 50% incidents of tumors of the genitourinary tract, mainly the mammary gland, the ovary, and this is in their control. It was a little higher in the radiated and a little sooner. And this is usually what you see with radiation.
Doctor, with the 300 hours across India, would that be all in one dose?
Yes, it was,
Would that cause any radiation burn at all?
No. What they did, well, if you give 300 R acutely to a beagle, it will kill some of them acutely. But in this program, you see, the reason for this study, you may be interested in this, in the late 40s, we as a nation undertook a program to develop a manned nuclear bomber. And this would require then a crew on a fairly long mission. And because it was nuclear power, there would be some radiation exposure. And the predicted doses were around 200 R accumulated dose. And they were we were going to hold it to that. I happened to be in another aspect of this. I was a consultant to the AEC and Air Force on this thing in the later phases. And it wasn't because of our committee that when Kennedy came in, you know, they zilched the program after they put in about $1 billion into it. You have invested about $1 billion in the manned nuclear bomber, which hasn't flown yet, although they had the runway almost completed at Arco, Idaho, they had the hangar. We could have had a Goonie bird going in the late 50s, I mean a slow one. But they kept changing the mission. Now they're talking about it again. See? One of the reasons that they were considering it, well, there were many. But you see, if you have a nuclear-propelled bomber, you wouldn't have to worry about foreign bases anymore. I mean, you could take off from here. But that was part of the problem. I mean, there weren't very many people who wanted a nuclear-propelled bomber taking off over their house, you know, or going over their city, or Trump coming in for a landing. Because there are a certain percentage, although small, who might not make it. And they're carrying a pretty good load of radiation. But I think that Russians are probably still working on it, and I've heard that we may be going back to it. I was only working from the standpoint of the biomedical aspects of this. What are the risks, hazards from this kind of a thing? And this was one of the studies we were underway. And what they did, instead of giving just 300 R or 100 R, they fractionated to give smaller amounts. Unfortunately, they didn't set up the experiment right. They needed more animals to really show the effects of fractionation. And this is a very important thing, that is the effect of fractionating a dose versus an acute dose. But let's get back to the curve now. Now here's what happens, and some of this is Hardin Jones's work from the University of California. And let us say that this is the curve for the mortality curve, or the age-specific mortality for a population. Now if you, and sort of this is the lethal bound up here, huh? I mean, this is sort of when you get there and go out feet first, sort of. Well, if you have a certain dose of radiation, you can quantitate it. If you go to a certain radiation dose, like in our case, maybe 100 R at this point in life, essentially, you get here sooner, you see? You get there sooner. Hardin Jones has quantitated that. To an extent with radiation, he's taken the acute dose and shown an effective shortening of the lifespan. But let us take overweight. If you're, say, 20 pounds overweight, you assume a new curve. you're on another line. And chances are maybe this is, he's quantitated maybe about it might affect you 20 or 30 pounds, depending on your weight, you see. This may be 10 years, you see. And that's a lot more than this 100 R radiation. I can't remember that figure exactly, but I do remember it for one pack a day and two packs a day of cigarettes. And essentially with one pack a day, it's 6 years. And with two packs a day, essentially 12 years. You get there quite a bit sooner. And in fact, most things that you do, I mean, you're moving in this direction rather than down here. However, if you watch your diet, if you exercise, if you lower your dietary intake of fats, but not to eliminate them, live a clean life, some of the Swedes used to do, and some of the Scandinavians, you're on a pretty good curve. In fact, if you look at the data, if you're a bachelor, I forgot to mention that, if you're a bachelor, you're on a new line up here. I mean, being a bachelor costs you about 8 years or so. When Hardin Jones told us that, we were in an audience like this, and I says, Hardin, but you must be careful with this information, because my observations have been that it depends on who you marry.
you know. Because it could be, it might even be higher. You know. But if you add up all this information, I've forgotten one other point. If you live in the city versus the country, you're also at a disadvantage. Like if you live in L.A. or Brooklyn or something like this.
Any difference in pastor men and pastor girls in that shortening life?
I'm not sure. Of course, men have much shorter lifespan than women, considerably less. I think that probably data is available, but I don't recall it. But to add it all up, that the difference between a woman living in rural Sweden with children, who's also married, and with her, comparing her with a bachelor, an overweight bachelor in Brooklyn, smoking two packs a day, is about 35 years.
So if you live there, you better move out. And now let's see, where am I? Well, I think we have now, we've sort of looked at this problem. Some of you may have some more questions. We of course are getting more and more people who are older. And we're retiring them sooner. And what are we going to do about it? It's a very disturbing thing to me. And a lot of people, of course, are not really ready and prepared for it. There are many people who are occupying probably ill-run home for the aged today. Life has become essentially meaningless for them, and nobody cares. Huh? And this is a very sad situation. I made quite a study of home for the aged lately, because my father, prior to his death, lived in one for a time. We've just put our mother-in-law in one not long ago. And I visited several others, people in them, to observe how do they run the operations, because I'm interested from this standpoint. And I'd say that one of the most responsive audiences to a talk on Holden Village was a small home for the aged in Sacramento, California. That a great fellow named Oscar Johnson helped initiate. And one of the fellows who, a lawyer who was involved in this program and who is sort of treasurer for this group, will be up here the last week in July, a lawyer named Basie and his family. And because of this, then I had entry to most of the churches in the Sacramento area to give a talk on Holden. But it was a very rewarding experience to visit with these people. And you'll be surprised what you find there. And certainly I commend this activity to you. And the reason that I asked whether Balgam was here, and I think I saw him, yes. Balgam is here, and Dr. Bergendorf is now here. I asked for him, and maybe others of you would like to sort of discuss briefly here before my concluding remarks on this problem. Is it wrong that we do what we do rather than like the Chinese, where we keep grandma and grandpa in our house, and they're the ones that raise the children while mother does the work, you know? And when you get to be grandparents, then you can play with the kids and teach them the wisdom of the ages and so forth. I mean, does that work better? Or are our houses too small? Or should some go to the home and some stay? I mean, these are real problems that face us today. And there's a lot of people that sort of drag grandma off to the old people's home, and there's probably two furrows they'll drag with heels, you know, all the way to the old people's home, where they really had to talk them into it. How should one prepare them for this? Is this the place for them? Do you want to comment on this, Balgam, or Dr. Brigandoff, or somebody else?
I think it's hard to make a general statement.
That's right.
There's just as many students among whom we got. And some like one thing, some other. My wife and I visited the Sun Valley, or Sun City down in Phoenix last year. It was one of the most impressive things I've ever seen. Yet there are other people enthusiastic about it. But to live in a village in Sun City where there are no children, no schools, no
yes.
I have observed in a home I operate in the basement of this man, and my patients that for the license to pass for 99 patients at the good cement society, I think most of them.
Yes. Where is this?
Spokane.
Spokane, yes.
And we have two female women together in the whole school. I've always observed these two women between 80 and 90. But when little children, now these little children do not observe that they are senile, but they will just sober up and carry on very nice conversation with the little children. But when they leave, they will have forgotten. But for that moment, they seem like the normal old people. So maybe with little children, maybe they wouldn't be in this particular state.
Do you want to address this subject a bit?
Well, I was going to propose a question for you to think about. Why is it that so many more of the church, when they plan a local community, they will look for a nice, park-like site, a little bit out of town? And I suggest the reason for this, they don't regard it, is old people, remind them that they're going to die themselves. Talking about the approach to the end here, and I think that it's a typical thing in our Lutheran church, as well as American culture, that we do not want to think about dying ourselves, and we don't want to look at anybody that reminds us of death. So we have old folks, when they're approaching the end, they tend to be removed to sanatoria or old folks. Heart is that we won't watch them ending. I think this is a real good thing for Christian people to think about how we feel about that, and whether that has something to do with our desire to have the old folks rather invisible, far away. And then the irony that I have been at for instance, conventions on aging, and every topic under the sun will come up except that these old people are going to die. And this happens whether it's a church conference night or a secular public culture conference night. And I just thought I'd suggest that note as a very thoughtful one to be gathered over this kind of a symbol of life. New life, isn't that the theme?
That's right.
Life, new
life. New life.
The theme of a whole Lutheran church, This is the title we celebrate the 450th anniversary of the Reformation. Life and life. Now, what is the function of death in life? And all people can remind
Yes, and you have given a sort of a prelude to tomorrow's talk, because tomorrow we're going to look at the subject of death, how we should face it and so forth. Yes, we have two hands here. Yes.
And you feel so sorry for people that just sit there and have nothing to do all day. They can't read anymore, most of them can't hear well, they can't take part in any activity. It seems like you just sit there and lie there waiting to die. You feel so sorry for them, you just wonder what can be done for them.
Yes, I'll address this remark after Ms. Belgum. Very, very good. Yes. Yes. Yes, Gertrude. Yes, Chief.
Transportation can become a great problem with older people after they like my mother never did drive. But
my mother couldn't either, but she drove in a way, but
all these things that they would enjoy, they cannot enjoy.
That's right. So I think we've hit on several points here, and most of what it says is that we got a job to do, huh? I mean, we have a lot of these homes now, and we can't move them from where they are. We need more homes. So what can we do? We can give them more activity. We can bring them in more into our homes. We can do more visitation. We can try to inspire the leadership to have them more active. We heard the other night, and I was really thrilled to hear Ross Heide and what they're doing down in San Francisco. If we're on planning boards, we can say, well, let's plant them so they're closer in to where the life is rather than maybe out in a park, or at least have some where some people are interested in children. Now, in Handling, for example, I think the ideal situation is with the chief's mother. She's in a home where she knows a lot of people. She's in the area where she spent most of her life. Whenever she wants to, she can come and see us in California. She spends a period of time there, but she always told herself she'd never live with her daughter for any extended period of time. Not because she doesn't get along with her, they get along pretty well, but she doesn't feel that this is where she belongs. And she, after about 6 weeks in our wild household, she's very thankful, I think, to get back to the home. And to her, the psychology is pretty good there, because she's in, you know, part of it is, you're better off than the next one, you know? I mean, and there's so many that boy, and she can help them to an extent, and there are many people visiting her, but the main thing, and the chief burns out of thing, if there are some people there to come and take you out, this means a very great, it's very meaningful, and you can't just let them sit there. Now, the other thing is that, now, what am I promoting here, that you just live a longer life? What is important is that you live a full life. And there are really two concepts of time. Most of us only think of one concept of time. Now, of course, whenever you start talking about time, it's like St. Augustine. He knew what time was until someone asked him what it was, and then he didn't know. But the biblical concept of time is really twofold. It's not only that concept of time of ours, which is chronos, or the root for chronological age, or our watches. It's sort of a mechanical movement of minutes and hours. The watch I have is called a chronometer. It's a quantitation kind of thing, and it's so many years. But there's another concept, I don't know how you pronounce it, I just read it, but it's kairos. Is it kairos?
Kairos,
yeah. And kairos time, and that's a wonderful word to me, because it's time that is measured in experience. And some time, I'm sure you can think of it, many of our times are more meaningful than others. And you remember the time when you fell in love, or when you're going to fall in love. This will be a very meaningful time. When you come to Holden, I mean, this is a very meaningful time, perhaps. And time sort of almost, well, it doesn't stand still, but it's a time when something changed your life. I mean, you recall this as a great event, where some of our life is sort of like nothing. So then this kairos time, it depends on the content, the opportunity, the self-realization or happiness. And when you relate it sort of to the Christ event, time in which faith happens. And we're not limited then by time and space, but by God's time. So what is important then is that we make life more meaningful, and we rate it not by quantity, but by quality. It's break time, and you can go up and get some low-calorie coffee, and hit the rolls lightly.